Maja Waha Winter and Galvia, August Falsha Gaji, Galway Talks, Lum Hain, John Morley, Chocta News, and Nyov Naw. The date for lodging planning application for the City Club Defence Scheme is now kicked out to 2027. Remarkable story behind P1 Predict F1 app. Illegal dumping on a council site in the east of the city is highlighted. Eamon Malley joins us on his Eyewitnesses to War and Peace book. It's the Cheltenham Festival. We'll have a big charity bet and preview of all the action with George McDonough and Boyle Sport. An Afghan human rights defender joins us in studio. And we have Music Mornings. This morning, that's with Jake Carter. All that plus lots, lots more coming up between now and 12 midday. Good morning. And a very good morning to you. Welcome into today's programme. If you want to get a text and WhatsApp into us throughout the course of the morning, you can do on our number. That's 086-3833-553. You can also phone Fiona on reception at 0917-00077 and email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. And I promise all the people in Salt Hill listening to us this morning, I'll be making phone calls later to finalise our lineup for our Community Matters show this Friday, coming from O'Connor's Barn, Salt Hill, between 9 and 12. A lot of good ideas flowing, and we'll hopefully bring you all that on Friday morning as well. More on that later in the week, though. Now, though, I want to start with a very serious issue, and it's very serious because, as we heard there in our weather forecast, there are unusually high tides, and I'm joined on the line now by Councillor John Connolly, Councillor for the City. John, good morning.
Good morning, John.
This arose after a meeting last week, Councillor Connolly. You might just set the scene for us. I suppose you and others are outraged that the estimated date for lodging a planning application for the City Flood Defence Scheme is now kicked out to 2027.
Yes, John, that's correct. Last Wednesday, all councillors were invited to a briefing on this matter in City Hall. And regretfully, we were informed that the date by which a planning application will be submitted for the development of the city's flood defences has been pushed back further. It had been expected that a planning application would be lodged in 2024-2025. And I suppose I took from that to mean quarter four 2024, quarter one 2025. But unfortunately, now the news we received last Wednesday indicates that no planning application will be submitted now until 2027. So it's very regretful news. And, you know, I think that it's going to come as a big setback to people who live in those parts of the city that are impacted by flooding. And we've seen, John, the prevalence of coastal flooding in the city has increased significantly in recent years. You know, the winter of 13-14, January 16, again, 18-19. And of course, we saw this year already, we've had a number of storms which have meant that we have had to close certain roads within the city due to the threat of coastal flooding. So the setback here and the date being put back to 2027, very disappointing news.
Okay, now this has been jointly developed by the council and the OPW and another company as well, but have you been given any reasons as to why this has been kicked out?
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose up to this point in the project, the council were undertaking hydraulic modelling. So that was an assessment of the city, its waterways, the Salmon Weir Barrage, the canal network, the historic flood event, river gauge surveys, the existing flood defences. So a very thorough assessment has taken place as to where the city is at risk, what's causing that risk. Obviously, we know climate change is behind it ultimately, but why certain parts of the city are at more risk than others. Now, evidently, it seems that having undertaken that study, and actually that study went through four drafts, the most recent one was completed in January, we now know that the scheme needed is much more significant than what was originally intended, and that there are parts of the city that the analysis has shown will require flood defences that maybe initially wasn't expected that they would. And also, I suppose, the nature of the defence we'll have to put up is going to have to be more significant and stronger possibly than what we originally expected to. So I suppose that has caused one delay, that the hydraulics modelling took that length of time and it was so thorough. But interestingly, there's two other aspects, I suppose, that are causing a delay. One is the complexity of what we need to design. But secondly, and interestingly, the OPW and the council have felt that we're other cities are advanced. They have come unstuck in the planning process. And we've seen in Cork City recently, the effort to develop flood relief defences in Cork City was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. We also see in Middleton, the project there has been upheld, or held up, excuse me, in the planning process. And to try and, I suppose, limit the impact of the of such a delay in Galway. The local authority and the OPW have decided to do extensive public consultation, and that's it's known as pre-statutory public consultation. And it's expected that the OPW and the council will do three different points in the progression of the plan. They'll do this non-statutory public consultation in the hope that that will lead to less complexity and less complication going through the planning process. So they're the reasons, essentially, John, the complexity of the scheme and the desire to do the non-statutory public consultation, which hopefully might, and it may not, reduce the complexity or the complications going through the planning system.
Yeah. Do you support that move by the local councillor? Do you think it's a bit over the top, or what's your assessment of it?
Well, I did suggest, John, that I felt, you know, was it really necessary? And I feel that the OPW certainly sensed that, you know, the project in Cork has taken much longer through the planning process than they would have hoped. And they do hope that that might overcome, that the pre-statutory public consultation might overcome that delay. I did ask, though, John, that would it not be possible that we would look at the locations here and develop location-specific solutions? So let's look at the Spanish Arch. Let's look at a solution for there. Let's look at Sawtill. Let's look at a solution for there. And we must remember, John, we're talking in the city here about building a defence against coastal flooding and river flooding. And we're building a defence system which will hopefully be strong enough to withstand a 1 in 200-year event of coastal flooding and a 1 in 100-year event of river flooding. But I did ask, could we not look at area-specific locations? And the response I got was that, you know, the solution, each solution could have a knock-on impact on another location. And because of that, it's actually more prudent and it's going to be less time-consuming to come up with one solution for the entire city and go for a planning application then. But it is disappointing news. And I think, John, what we need to do now is we need to look at those areas of the cities that we can see, that we know are suffering this on a regular basis, and perhaps engage with householders there, engage with businesses there, and try and see, can we come up with, to assist those with individual solutions to prevent their premises from being flooded.
Well, can there even be temporary relief solutions for certain areas while also doing the overall approach for the whole city? I'm looking at the map of the scheme now and the scheme area. It is vast. It goes right across the coastline of the city and back out as far as I see the Headford Road there and Menlaw as well.
Yeah, and Lough Atholla is one of the areas. I understand, John, that initially it wasn't considered that they might need some type of flood defence scheme, but now they understand from the hydraulics modelling that it will be needed. I do accept that point, and I think we do need to look at that. I think we need to look at where we are going to, where we know these problems are arising frequently, and we don't need to look too far. We don't need much evidence to know that there are certain parts of the city that are at greater risk than others. And I think we need to look both at an individual basis with the householder, with the business owner, and say, look, we want to help you to make sure, you know, that we limit the damage that could be done to your premises, or that we totally stop your premises from being at risk of flooding, and engage at that level and try and see, can we develop solutions there?
Now, the scale of work needed, as you mentioned, is far greater than previously thought. Is that due in part to the nature of Galway City being a medieval city? We've seen it with different road projects and different infrastructure projects in the city, that the medieval nature of the city has complicated things. Is that true for this as well?
Well, I'd say it is, but I'd also say the environmental sensitivities of the city also. I mean, the Galway Bay is an SAC. It's also an SPA, a special protection area. And that goes right from the estuary all the way out along the coastline. And also, of course, the Corrib enjoys some protected status as well. So that's an additional complication in Galway that you may not have in other areas. I suppose one thing we can take some comfort from, John, is that the hydraulics modelling has provided us with, you know, the full extent of flood risk in the city. And we now know for future years where we need to build these defences and the extent to which we need to build them.
Now, if we listen to our neighbours in Europe and different environmental experts as well, 2030 has always been highlighted as a significant date in terms of sea level rises. Is that something you're concerned about with this being pushed out to 2027 in terms of planning?
Absolutely, John, because like even the initial timelines that suggested we would be at planning maybe later this year did suggest perhaps a 3 to 4 year development process. You know, a construction phase. The construction phase was intended maybe to go to 3 years. So if we enter the planning process in 2027, and look, take it that, you know, we accept the council's view and the OPW's view that we'll have a less complex planning process because of the pre-consultation work, the pre-statutory consultation work, I'd say the planning process, you're still talking, you know, and again, this is, you know, this is just an estimate, but you're still talking 18 months, I would say, for it to get through the planning process, a scale of this nature. And would we know the delays that Bord Pleanála are already suffering? So look, you're up to 2030 at that point, by the point maybe that you have a grant of planning. So unfortunately, John, it's very regretful. It's a very disappointing news. It's going to come as a big setback, as I said, to those parts of the city. But you are now talking of a situation where the development of this project will be post 2030. And look, for those people who are living this nightmare, who are at risk of this flooding throughout the winter and the prevalence of it that we're now suffering, it's going to become as very disappointing news.
When we had the Minister O'Donovan on the programme when there was flooding in Goa City and County, indeed, before Christmas, he highlighted the Habitats Directive and how the government's hands are tied in terms of short measures. Does that factor into this more wider plan in terms of the Corrib Costa?
Yeah, as I said, John, I think one of the reasons why we face these types of delays is the environmental sensitivity and the Habitats Directive. The Habitats Directive, I suppose, is directly responsible for the designation of the Bay Area as an SAC and indeed the Special Protection Area as well. So there's no doubt about it. And again, that might be something, John, that is telling the OPW officials and telling the council officials that we need this level of pre-statutory public consultation, because whatever scheme is developed here has to be cognizant and aware of the environmental sensitivities there and the Habitats Directive and any potential threat that's faced to any species that might be on any list for protection through its development.
Still though, no matter how much consultation you do, there's always a chance that people will still object and will keep this in on Bord Pleanála or wherever they keep it for many years to come.
Yes, as I said, the Cork scheme went all the way to the Supreme Court. There's always that risk. And again, I did ask the officials in City Hall, you know, when we met last Wednesday, how confident they would be that such an extent of pre-statutory public consultation could avoid that. And of course, they can't be, because, you know, in a democracy we live in, people are entitled to bring and to challenge decisions of public bodies. So there's always that risk. So there is. But again, I suppose, you know, the other thing I have to stress, though, is the complexity of what will be developed and the extent of it and the parts of the city that will be covered by it. And designing the scheme at this point to bring to planning for one of that nature is going to be extensive. So it's a combination of those two issues. I suppose, you know, it is the desire that the non-statutory public consultation will avoid or will limit the extent to which people can challenge any decision the Bord Pleanála might make in the courts, but it can't guarantee it.
Mm. Bottom line is, where are we at it now? What stage are we at, or what's the next steps, or what are you calling for?
Well, what I'm seeking, John, I suppose, specifically is that the council now would look at, I suppose, those areas of the city where we know face the threat of flooding, even this week as we speak, that we engage with the residents and the business there directly on a one-to-one basis, and we see how we can come up with solutions to ensure that their premises and their properties are secured in the event of such flooding. And try and make sure that we satisfy people, that the local authority is doing its best in the short term to make sure that with the extent of flooding that we are at risk of, which the nature of the coastal flooding that we've seen, it doesn't threaten property, it doesn't damage property. We must do that. We can't leave people waiting for this long to develop a general scheme in the knowledge that we have that they face risk imminently.
How do you want to see that in a practical sense? Because I know the local authority is very active in terms of sandbags and different flood defence measures when there is the threat of flooding.
Yeah, and that is the current response, along with closing of roads and, you know, putting out public awareness to people to make sure they don't leave their cars in certain car parks. I'm not sure if that's going to cut it, John. I really don't. I think we need to directly engage. We need to look at local engineering solutions for householders and premises to make sure that they're fully, that, you know, that they are not at risk of damage to their property
like
by the threat of local. Well, I you know, every morning, many mornings, I come in by the Spanish Arch myself, and I see some of the premises there facing the Spanish Arch have an apparatus at their door that seems to be of a metal or steel nature that they put there that protects them in the event of flooding. And other such schemes and engineering solutions that I'm sure are out there for premises and for individual householders to limit the damage that could occur to their property should it be at risk of flooding.
I believe I saw a type of technology in another country indeed where the gullies of the streets could actually raise up and work out as flood defence measures, and they actually use sort of a ball and chain method that when the water subsides they drop down as well. So, but that's a lot of engineering and it's not just that simple to do.
No, none of these solutions are simple. There's no doubt about it. Any solution where you're looking at you know, the volume of water that could come off the coast and our current stormwater drainage system, it would take detailed engineering work to make sure you come up with a proper solution there. So, but again, like, if there is something that can be done in the short term, we can't rule it out. Because as I say, John, I don't think we can leave it till post 2030 to develop the full solution. We must look at, you know, how we can make sure that people are protected and households are protected.
Now, when there was flooding before Christmas, government stepped up to the mark and provided some grant funding indeed for people. But the other issue that's in many ways probably out of government's control is insurance. And how can people get insured after they've been flooded?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I heard that being raised extensively after the flooding. And I suppose what I'm doing here by talking to you today is trying to make sure that we don't come to that situation. We don't come to a situation whereby the government are being asked after a premises has been flooded or after a household has been flooded to intervene at that point. That we can make sure at this point, you know, that we, and again, that we know now of those areas that are specifically at risk. There's a greater study here, and we're risk-proofing many parts of the city for the future. But we know that at the moment that there are certain parts of the city that face imminent risk. They face risk this week because, you know, you've announced it there yourself. There's a high tide. Luckily this morning, the weather was calm and it didn't have the impact that it could have had. So I think what I'm suggesting to the government is rather than coming in after the point, and providing money for the cleanup, and to avoid any situation where people are uncertain as to whether their insurance is going to cover them in the event of this happening, that we must take steps now. And we must take them specifically in the knowledge that we know the city scheme will not be developed for some time.
But do you think your colleagues in government need to be harder on the insurance industry in this regard?
I don't think they should be letting people off the hook. I suppose, you know, when you ask people about the insurance policy that they have themselves in their own household, the fine detail of that may not be known to everybody. I'd struggle to define it for myself at the moment. I think the government must make sure that if people are paying insurance on a policy that covers certain things, that then they can claim for that cover. It would be, I think we would be letting people down if they were taking out insurance policies and they knew that they had a certain cover, and afterwards insurance companies could turn around and say, well, actually, we're not paying for that. I think the government can't allow that to happen.
Just a comment coming into us. There are councillors pushing planning to build on the swamp area. It's completely unsuitable. Because of the high tide yesterday, it's all flooded. It is a completely unsuitable place to build anything. Why are councillors pushing for planning here? Do you have any response to that?
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's, in fairness, what's happening at the moment is there is a master plan being developed for the swamp. That will include, John, an assessment of its suitability for any type of development. If the master plan says that the swamp isn't suitable for type of development because it risks flooding other parts of the city.
Another comment coming into us here. Bad planning by Go... I think we've lost Councillor Connolly there on the line. Just another comment coming in. Bad planning by the local authority again, RE Flooding. Look at Claren Bridge and Clare Galway. People in Claren Bridge still waiting for money promised in emergency aid. Absolutely, government can pass legislation for insurance to cover flooding where it happened again. And another listener says, if it was Dublin, John, it wouldn't be pushed out. Galway again forgotten about. Shame on the government. Councillor Connolly, back to us there. Did you hear that?
I'm here, John, if you can hear me.
Yeah, no, just a comment came into us, bad planning by local authorities, just to look at the situation in Claren Bridge and Clangowrie, and that people in Claren Bridge are still awaiting for money promised in emergency aid. Do you have any comment? I don't know if that's true.
Well, I don't know if that's true either, but I certainly will contact my colleagues in the Galway County Council and Deputy Rabbit, I think, and Deputy O'Quigg to see if that is the issue. I mean, it's disappointing to hear some months after the area was flooded that they still would be waiting for some support. I don't know if that's the case, like yourself, but I certainly am happy to follow it up.
Yeah, finally, just what's the mood like on the ground here in Galway City with the local business and different residential owners in flood risk areas, as we mentioned there, the high tides this week?
I'm sure they're concerned. Absolutely, they're concerned, I've no doubt. And like you say, like the local authority have responded by providing sandbags, and they have advised that, you know, there might be certain points and times when the roads might need to be closed. But I'm sure those businesses and those residents are concerned about right at the high tides this week and the potential for high winds, which might cause flooding.
Okay. Councillor John Conley, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks. Now, if you want to get a comment into us, do so straight away to 086-3833-553. That is our text and WhatsApp number. You can also phone Fiona on reception, 0917-00077. Email comments at galwaybayfm.ie, and they're coming in thick and fast this morning. We have a lovely story coming the way next about a Formula One prediction app and a man who lives just around the corner from us here on Sandy Road who has developed it. Stay tuned. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Delighted to say I'm joined in studio now by Dara Canning, who is the founder of P1 Predict. And Dara sits opposite me now. Dara, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Very well, thanks for joining us today. Talk to me about your story though, Dara, because you've started this P1 Predict app, but you started it from, I suppose, a place of turmoil and upheaval. Tell us about your story.
Yeah, absolutely. It hasn't come from the nicest of situations, but we tried to make the most of it. I suppose this particular story starts during COVID, and like everyone, we had plenty of time on our hands during the lockdowns. We were actually separated from family, as a lot of people were, and we lived up here in Galway, and our families live in Westmeath and Roscommon, so we couldn't see anyone. We had a lot of time, and I suppose after we had our fill of online quizzes and banana bread, we started switching over to Netflix, and I love documentaries, both of us do, myself and my partner, so we started getting through some documentaries. We watched Tiger King, of course, with everybody else, and then somebody recommended Drive to Survive, and that kind of lit me up. I was interested in Formula One when I was a kid, but then this kind of reintroduced me and kind of reignited that fire and passion that I had for it. It was just really interesting to see all the stories behind it, and as I looked into it, it was a lot of technical side. There was a technical side that I hadn't really realised existed when I was younger, a lot of data driven kind of technology in there, which was quite in line with where I was kind of in with my career, so we started watching that, got really interested. Friends of ours were watching it too, and it was just a talking point for us during COVID and something that we could connect over. I suppose as part of that, I started to branch out a little bit. I started sim racing. I got a steering wheel. And that was like a big purchase for me during the lockdown, and I felt a bit like a kid, but there's a huge community of sim racers. That kind of brought me more into the Formula One side of things, kind of getting to understand and ask questions about how a car is set up. And I suppose when the lockdown started to loosen and the F1 season came back, we wanted to kind of enjoy it together, and it kind of started to bring us as friends back together. And we were watching races on Sundays with each other when the restrictions had loosened. So that's where it started. And then I suppose once the interest was there and life was going back to normality, we were going back playing sports, and one evening I was down playing five-a-side soccer and something just didn't feel right with my left leg. I felt like my balance was off, and then my Achilles snapped out of nowhere. I actually thought someone had kicked me because the pain, it hits you right in the calf. So it was quite hard to diagnose. I thought my leg had broken at the start because I was holding it and I couldn't move my foot properly.
Yeah.
A friend of mine brought me home. We had a look. There was just something not right. We went to A&E and they confirmed that I had snapped my Achilles. So pretty quickly, I kind of lost a lot of independence and gained a lot of time. I went back home that night in a cast with crutches and had to kind of reevaluate where things were at. A week later, both myself and my partner, Ellen, got COVID. So I had lost the ability to get around, and then we couldn't leave the house for 10 days. And the F1 season happened to be starting, which was kind of a saving grace at the time because I was feeling quite sorry for myself, I suppose, at the time. So I started to kind of toy with an idea about, with our friends and with our friend group who were into Formula One, about just making predictions for how the season would go. That was how it started. I just wanted to get a rough idea about what people thought would happen. And I said, okay, we'll capture this in a Google sheet. And then I decided, well, let's add a little kind of, you know, a regular element to this. So I said, every week we'll predict our top five and we'll add it to a Google sheet and we'll see who scores points and make it a bit competitive because I had the time. So I kind of quickly built something over the course of a few days just before the season started, and we started using it, and we really enjoyed it. In its simple format as it was, like a Google sheet linked with a simple form, it made all the difference. It kind of came a little bit competitive, added that extra layer of engagement over the weekend, because there are some races where you've got the likes of Max Verstappen 20 seconds ahead after three laps. Yeah. It's like, you need something else to look forward to. So that was the very first iteration of it. And like I said, I had a lot of time. I wasn't going anywhere because I couldn't get out and about as I normally would. And started building on that. 3 months later, I'm back walking after physio and going through all of that. And decided to celebrate. We went camping, went kayaking. After the kayaking, we said, let's jump in. Let's jump off the pier. And, you know, as a bit of a celebration and a bit of freedom, as I jumped off the pier, I snapped the Achilles again. And this time it was really bad. I went into the consultant. They did some MRI scans and it was completely snapped. It had never properly healed at all. So this time I had to get surgery, and that meant another 3 months off my feet, which was a devastating blow because, you know, we had just come out of lockdown and I felt I had a bit of freedom back again. And then the first time I got the injury, it was like going back into a lockdown. And then I just kind of, you know, gotten through that. And like, obviously I had a lot of support from Ellen, my partner, my family, and you need a lot of good people around you when you're kind of in that headspace. Made sure that we were looking forward all the time. And then for it to happen again was devastating. And then I was told that it could be 5 months before I get the surgery. So in my head, I'm like, well, I'm going to have to go through this like process of healing and then have it snapped again and go through it again. So it was looking kind of daunting, but luckily we got a cancellation after 2 weeks. I was able to get the surgery back into a cast, back into a boot for another 3 months. But I got through it. We had some family commitments as well, which meant that Ellen had to learn how to drive, and there was a lot of things that had to change. It didn't just impact me. A lot of other people were impacted. But at the whole time, I had this time and this space, and I was just experimenting with ideas and writing down thoughts and ideas about how we could grow the app. I get back out of the boot, I get back walking, and come December of that year, so 6 months after or 9 months after I had initially injured myself, I got called into a meeting at work. I work remotely, so it was an online Zoom meeting at 3 o'clock on the 1st of December, and 10 minutes later I had no job, and I find out that all 13 other members of my team also went through the same thing at 3 o'clock that day as well. We were all axed, so I didn't even get to say goodbye to any of them. It was like, gone. You get brought into the meeting, you get cut, and that's it. It was quite traumatic for everybody. But again, trying to find the positives, it was incredibly frustrating. Like there were tears and there were tantrums. Like it was quite hard to manage all of that, especially after the year that we had and the years before that as well, with COVID and everything that brought. So it was like the mental side of things was quite tough. But again, trying to find the positives in it. We've constantly tried to tell ourselves that there are certain things that are happening to us for a reason, and trying to figure out what that is. Normally that happens afterwards when you can retrospectively look back and say, right, well, this happened and because of that, we got here. So I said, right, well, it's December, Christmas is coming up. You don't normally get that much time off for Christmas. Let's take the month and, you know, try and enjoy it. So we did that. We had a good Christmas. And then January, I was like, right, I'm going to take some time off work because I'm burnt out from everything that's happened. You know, I put myself into work and gave it my all, and always have. I was burnt out because I luckily wasn't impacted during COVID. I can continue to work through it, which was a great distraction, but it was quite tiring because the industry that I was in took off, like it was e-commerce. So that got incredibly busy and there was a lot of pressure and stress with that. So I said, I'm going to take 3 to 6 months off here for myself and try and build something. So from January 1st, I was like, right, let's get going. And I said, I'm going to challenge myself now and go back to learning how to code and build on this app. So I said, I want it to be live, I want it to be online, and I want to push myself and get, you know, people outside of my friends or like my circle of friends to use this. And I built it, tested out a prototype with friends and family, got some really good feedback, made changes. And then when even I was about to launch it, and I was like, you know, I'm not an expert in Formula One. I'm not an expert in this kind of stuff. Like, who am I to be putting this out there? And I just said, no, stop. Put it out, see what happens. And like within 24 hours, there was nearly 100 people signed up. And that to me blew my mind. I had to put a stop on it because I wasn't too sure if the app could take that much traffic or that many people in. So I called it off after 100, after the first 24 hours, and said, no, we'll run the test this year just to see what happens. What can I fix? What can I improve with this kind of closed beta? And it went really well. Some of the obvious errors came up quickly and I was able to fix them. And you know, the fear about something like going down, and you know, there I kind of found that I'm able to, you know, take that on and fix things. So I was able to fix all of these issues as we went along. It grew. We got some great feedback. I seen people coming back every single week people I didn't know. So like, I know friends and family are super supportive and they'll come back. But when you see outsiders, people that you don't know coming in and using this thing that you've built, it's really encouraging. So the whole season, we were getting some really good feedback. I got a new job in the middle of the year, and that kind of took back some of the time. I couldn't give as much time as I wanted to, but obviously you have to pay the bills as well. And we kept going with that. It wrapped up at the end of last year. My partner Ellen won it. She was delighted with that. Fair play to her. Beat me, beat everybody else. So that's the first P1 Predict World Champion is my partner Ellen. And yeah, we took a bit of time. We're also, look, there's a housing crisis. We're trying to find accommodation. So that also has to take priority. But in the meantime, we've been trying to build on it. This year, we've got a bit more energy, a bit more time and space mentally. And I'm relaunching it. We opened it up. We've had a huge interest this year because we've done a proper push. And we have some amazing things lined up for the year, so that the app is live at p1predict.com. You can sign up for free. We've got some events planned this year, some viewing parties for some Formula One races. There'll be simulator competitions there. There'll be F1 themed quizzes and prizes. We're building out all of that. We are working with some F1 influencers as well to build out their own branded leagues, which has been a really, really cool thing for us to do. Just branching out. We're engaging with the community online and we're kind of building up our following there. So things have turned the corner. There have been so many setbacks the whole way, but we've kind of persisted through. We've tried to find the positives and kind of push through as much as we can. And I feel like, you know, the interest is there. Like when we opened it again this year, I wasn't expecting a huge response because I thought, well, everyone that was interested signed up last year, and it just overwhelmed me again this year. Mm. So we're going to build on it. It's something that we really enjoy. I'm roping in help from my partner, Ellen. She's doing the marketing side of things for me as well, because it's not my forte, but it's something that we both love. And it's helped us in a couple of different ways as well, just a bit of a distraction through some hard times.
Mm. I think it's a lovely story. And I think one thing about it as well, you've been on both sides of the fence in terms of entrepreneurialism and getting the steady paycheck as well, and you're balancing that now. Mm-hmm. But how have you found it, and can you see this going in a direction where it could be the standalone job, or you could create a business out of it itself?
Yeah, that's always going to be the goal. I suppose the first business I had, which was Spoogle, it was a web design business. I was very young when I started that, and I was quite naive. I went after everything, but like, I burnt myself out. I was working long hours, and I may not have been prioritizing the areas that you need to prioritize, or focusing on kind of like the financial side of things. I was just going after everything. Whereas now I'm in my mid-30s, and I feel a bit more grounded. I feel like I'm a bit more level-headed. So yeah, I do want to build it out to be its own business. We have plans. We are putting the strategy in place now to make that happen. But we're doing it cautiously. I have a really good job. I work with some absolutely incredibly talented people, and I enjoy the job that I do as well. So I'm kind of lucky in that my bills are being paid regardless of how well this goes, which takes a lot of the pressure off. When I was running Spoogle, there was a gun to my head, like it had to work. That makes, you know, making decisions under pressure isn't always easy. Whereas this feels a little bit more like it's enjoyable. It feels like play. It's an app, and it's, I suppose one thing I always wanted was just, if I was to build something again, and I remember after I kind of wound down Spoogle, I was like, I don't think I'm going to be self-employed again, because it's a lot. And in that kind of service related industry, you're building things for other people. and you're watching them develop and grow, and they're building out their dreams and their businesses, and you're just kind of helping them do that. And I just decided, look, I'm not going to do that kind of business again, but if there was something that I could build that scratches my own itch or something that I'm passionate about, I would consider it. And this has just kind of raised its head throughout all of that adversity. This has kind of popped up and been like, you know, it wasn't a business at the start. It was a game for us. It was just something to pass the time. And now I'm like, this could be something. So I won't be giving up my day job anytime soon. But the plan is the goal would be for the next, you know, in the next 2 to 5 years, this could be something that supports myself full time. It could be something that, and I would love to see it grow in that I can hire people. I'd love to have a team of designers and developers and marketers, and, you know, content creators, and that we can kind of create our own. There's other industries as well that we're kind of starting to explore. So it's not just Formula One. So we're starting to grow, and we want this to grow, but it's going to be done at a steady pace. I'm not going to rush into things like I did when I was younger.
Mm. And in terms of the whole sector it's in, that F1, it has exploded since the Netflix documentary there a few years back. Is the sky the limit? You mentioned earlier on when you first did the first prototype, the beta version, that you were limited to 100 people. Is the sky the limit now in
terms
of...
Absolutely, yeah. The sky is the limit. Like you said, it's an area of interest that is growing rapidly, and like, it doesn't seem like it's going to slow down anytime soon. You can see that F1 are trying to crack the American market. That's something that we'll be focusing on too. There are other sports in America that we want to kind of start to explore as well. The sky is the limit. We've opened it up this time with no limits, and there have been a lot of signups. We're keeping an eye on things from a technology perspective and how, like, our servers are handling that and how the code base works under that kind of a load. So we are learning a lot as we go. But yeah, I'm not going to put a limit on it this time. I'm going to leave it open, and we'll face any challenges that come out of it. But at the moment, like, the feedback has been incredible. We've kind of got the attention of, you know, some people there. Well, we can't say much just yet because it's kind of in talks. But you know, we're getting attention from the right places, and that's really encouraging. And it's motivating. So yeah, we want to grow this to be as big as it possibly could be.
Mm. Finally, it is a team effort, and you have great help there from your partner Ellen as well.
Absolutely.
And I know that she's actually got the attention of a lot of celebrities as well in her line of work in terms of marketing.
Absolutely, and she's going to hate me saying this. But yeah, a few years ago, and we were just talking about this as we were waiting in the lobby, Ellen's a digital artist. That's one of her skills. And a few years ago, she set up Nell Illustrations, and she's taught herself how to use like the likes of Adobe Illustrator and Photoshop to create art, and did it for herself. I do believe that I might have been the first portrait that she ever did. But we'll have to double check that. But yeah, she started drawing celebrities and started like targeting certain, like the Grammys, the Oscars, and drawing these celebrities like through all hours of the night. And then she started to get attention from them. So Jennifer Lopez, Beyonce. I remember one night her phone just blew up because Beyonce had reshared one of her pieces, and her phone, like, it was going crazy. And then one evening she got an email from a team that said they were working for Kim Kardashian.
Wow.
And we were all like, oh, this is kind of strange. This is a bit suspicious. And we went and looked into it, and they were her media team, and they wanted Ellen to be the featured artist on Kim Kardashian's website. Out of all the artists in the world that were drawing Kim Kardashian at the time, they chose Ellen. And she was on all the newspapers, radio stations. Yeah, it was wild. So she knows what she's doing. I've asked her to help for a reason, and she's just been doing... and helping me put a strategy together and doing some really good stuff for us as well.
It's a lovely story, and if people want to get more information on it, is it P1 Predict?
P1predict.com, yeah. Yep. It's up there. It'll tell you how to sign up for free. There's also a link on that page to our events, so if you're interested in joining or you want us to run an event in your city or town, sign up there, let us know, and we'll start to figure some stuff out. But yeah, P1predict.com.
And the Formula One season is getting off in earnest. Do you have any predictions for us?
I think it's P1 is easy to predict this year, thanks to Max Verstappen. So yeah, we're probably going to consider renaming it P2 Predict after this, but Verstappen's going to walk it, Red Bull are going to walk it. I'd say Perez is probably going to get second place, but interesting to keep an eye on the McLarens this year. I think they're in a far better position than they were at the start of last year, and I'd like to think that they're going to challenge for third, maybe second, depending on how Ferrari season goes. But yeah, keep an eye on the McLarens.
Very good. Well, Dara Canning, the founder of P1 Predict, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you very much.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Thanks once again to Dara Canning for speaking so candidly with me there before the ad break. And it just goes to show that LinkedIn, the world of LinkedIn, is not all it's cracked up to be. There's a lot more that goes on behind the scenes when people are starting up businesses as well. So thanks to Dara and indeed his partner for being so candid with us as well. To your comment lines very quickly, Valerie John, great programme, most enjoyable. And don't even look at cancer coming back. It may never, ever come back. And please God, it won't. Well spoken. And amazingly, you picked David Bowie, Trouble, when Michael Lester and I started writing a music column in the Tume Herald in 1974. That was one of his favourite songs, and I actually got to like it. Well done to both of you. And that comes in from our very own Tom Gilmore. And just a little announcement as well, that MacDara will be doing a gig organised by Galia Vlagailga in Galway City Library this Thursday at 6 in the evening, and one organised by Gaelga Lockeriach in Lochray Library at 7 o'clock on Friday. And both are part of the Shocton na Gaelga and are also free of charge. Garamila Mahagav, and that comes in from MacDara as well. So that should be a good night for all involved there. Still to come on the programme today, we'll be hearing about illegal dumping on a council site on Duishka Road. We also hear that work is to begin on a €4.8 million housing developments in Ardrahan and also in Ballinasloe. So all that plus lots of more coming up on Galway Talks between now and 12 midday. A very good morning to you. We're back after news.